For Halloween, I was a witch. Dora, my trick-or-treating partner, was a witch, too. We wore black capes fashioned from dyed pillowcases and conical hats with wide cardboard brims. We shaded our faces green with a broken eyeshadow that belonged to Dora's mother, and my mother gave us two burlap sacks that had once contained basmati rice for collecting candy. That year, our parents decided that we were old enough to roam the neighborhood unattended. Our plan was to walk from my house to Dora's, from where I was to call to say I had arrived safely, and then Dora's mother would drive me home. My father equipped us with flashlights, and I had to wear my watch and synchronize it with his. We were to return no later than 9 o'clock. When Mr. Pirzada arrived that evening, he presented me with a box of chocolate-covered mints. "In here," I told him and opened up the burlap sack. "Trick or treat!" "I understand that you don't really need my contribution this evening," he said, depositing the box. He gazed at my green face and the hat secured by a string under my chin. Gingerly, he lifted the hem of the cape, under which I was wearing a sweater and a zipped fleece jacket. "Will you be warm enough?" I nodded, causing the hat to tip to one side. He set it right. "Perhaps it is best to stand still." The bottom of our staircase was lined with baskets of miniature candy, and when Mr. Pirzada removed his shoes, he did not place them there as he normally did, but inside the closet instead. He began to unbutton his coat, and I waited to take it from him, but Dora called me from the bathroom to say that she needed my help drawing a mole on her chin. When we were finally ready, my mother took a picture of us in front of the fireplace, and then I opened the front door to leave. Mr. Pirzada and my father, who had not gone into the living room yet, hovered in the foyer. Outside, it was already dark. The air smelled of wet leaves, and our carved jack-o'-lantern flickered impressively against the shrubbery by the door. In the distance came the sounds of scampering feet and the howls of the older boys who wore no costume at all other than a rubber mask, and the rustling apparel of the youngest children, some so young that they were carried from door to door in the arms of their parents. "Don't go into any of the houses you don't know," my father warned. Mr. Pirzada knit his brows together. "Is there any danger?" "No, no," my mother assured him. "All the children will be out. It's a tradition." "Perhaps I should accompany them," Mr. Pirzada suggested. He looked suddenly tired and small, standing there in his splayed, stockinged feet, and his eyes contained a panic I had never seen before. In spite of the cold, I began to sweat inside my pillowcase. "Really, Mr. Pirzada," my mother said, "Lilia will be perfectly safe with her friend."
"But if it rains? If they lose their way?"
"Don't worry," I said. It was the first time I had uttered those words to Mr. Pirzada, two simple words I had tried but failed to tell him for weeks, had said only in my prayers. It shamed me now that I had said them for my own sake. He placed one of his stocky fingers on my cheek, then pressed it to the back of his own hand, leaving a faint green smear.
"If the lady insists," he conceded, and offered a small bow.
We left, stumbling slightly in our black pointy thrift store shoes, and when we turned at the end of the driveway to wave goodbye, Mr. Pirzada was standing in the frame of the doorway, a short figure between my parents, waving back. "Why did that man want to come with us?" Dora asked. "His daughters are missing." As soon as I said it, I wished I had not. I felt that my saying it made it true, that Mr. Pirzada's daughters really were missing and that he would never see them again.
"You mean they were kidnapped?" Dora continued. "From a park or something?"
"I didn't mean they were missing. I meant he misses them. They live in a different country and he hasn't seen them in a while, that's all." We went from house to house, walking along pathways and pressing doorbells. Some people had switched off all their lights for effect, or strung rubber bats in their windows. At the McIntyres, a coffin was placed in front of the door, and Mr. McIntyre rose from it in silence, his face covered with chalk, and deposited a fistful of candy corn into our sacks. Several people told me that they had never seen an Indian witch before. Others performed the transaction without comment. As we paved our way with the parallel beams of our flashlights, we saw eggs cracked in the middle of the road and cars covered with shaving cream
and toilet paper garlanding the branches of trees. By the time we reached Dora's house, our hands were chapped from carrying our bulging burlap bags, and our feet were sore and swollen. Her mother gave us bandages for our blisters and served us warm cider and caramel popcorn. She reminded me to call my parents to tell them I had arrived safely, and when I did, I could hear the television in the background. My mother did not seem particularly relieved to hear from me. When I replaced the phone on the receiver, it occurred to me that the television wasn't on at Dora's house at all. Her father was lying on the couch reading a magazine with a glass of wine on the coffee table, and there was saxophone music playing on the stereo. After Dora and I had sorted through our plunder and counted and sampled and traded until we were satisfied, her mother drove me back to my house. I thanked her for the ride, and she waited in the driveway until I made it to the door. In the glare of her headlights, I saw that our pumpkin had been shattered, its thick shell strewn in chunks across the grass. I felt the sting of tears in my eyes and a sudden pain in my throat, as if it had been stuffed with the sharp, tiny pebbles that crunched with each step under my aching feet. I opened the door, expecting the three of them to be standing in the foyer waiting to receive me and to grieve for our ruined pumpkin. But there was no one. In the living room, Mr. Pirzada, my father, and mother were sitting side by side on the sofa. The television was turned off, and Mr. Pirzada had his head in his hands. What they heard that evening, and for many evenings after that, was that India and Pakistan were drawing closer and closer to war. Troops from both sides lined the border, and Dhaka was insisting on nothing short of independence. The war was to be waged on East Pakistani soil. The United States was siding with West Pakistan, the Soviet Union with India, and what was soon to be Bangladesh. War was declared officially on December 4th, and 12 days later, the Pakistani army, weakened by having to fight 3,000 miles from their source of supplies, surrendered in Dhaka. All of these facts I know only now, for they are available to me in any history book in any library. But then it remained, for the most part, a remote mystery with haphazard clues. What I remember during those 12 days of the war was that my father no longer asked me to watch the news with them, and that Mr. Pirzada stopped bringing me candy, and that my mother refused to serve anything other than boiled eggs with rice for dinner. I remember some nights helping my mother spread a sheet and blankets on the couch so that Mr. Pirzada could sleep there, and high-pitched voices hollering in the middle of the night when my parents called our relatives in Calcutta to learn more details about the situation. Most of all, I remember the three of them operating during that time as if they were a single person, sharing a single meal, a single body, a single silence, and a single fear. In January, Mr. Pirzada flew back to his 3-story home in Dhaka to discover what was left of it. We did not see much of him in those final weeks of the year. He was busy finishing his manuscript, and we went to Philadelphia to spend Christmas with friends of my parents. Just as I have no memory of his first visit, I have no memory of his last. My father drove him to the airport one afternoon while I was at school. For a long time, we did not hear from him. Our evenings went on as usual, with dinners in front of the news. The only difference was that Mr. Pirzada and his extra watch were not there to accompany us. According to reports, Dhaka was repairing itself slowly, with a newly formed parliamentary government. The new leader, Sheikh Mujib Rahman, recently released from prison, asked countries for building materials to replace more than 1 million houses that had been destroyed in the war. Countless refugees returned from India, greeted, we learned, by unemployment and the threat of famine. Every now and then I studied the map above my father's desk and pictured Mr. Pirzada on that small patch of yellow, perspiring heavily, I imagined, in one of his suits, searching for his family. Of course, the map was outdated by then. Finally, several months later, we received a card from Mr. Pirzada commemorating the Muslim New Year, along with a short letter. He was reunited, he wrote, with his wife and children. All were well, having survived the events of the past year at an estate belonging to his wife's grandparents in the mountains of Shillong. His 7 daughters were a bit taller, he wrote, but otherwise they were the same, and he still could not keep their names in order. At the end of the letter, he thanked us for our hospitality, adding that although he now understood the meaning of the words thank you, they still were not adequate to express his gratitude. To celebrate the good news, my mother prepared a special dinner that evening, and when we sat down to eat at the coffee table, we toasted our water glasses, but I did not feel like celebrating. Though I had not seen him for months, it was only then that I felt Mr. Pirzada's absence. It was only then, raising my water glass in his name, that I knew what it meant to miss someone who was so many miles and hours away, just as he had missed his wife and daughters for so many months. He had no reason to return to us, and my parents predicted correctly that we would never see him again. Since January, each night before bed, I had continued to eat, for the sake of Mr. Pirzada's family, a piece of candy I had saved from Halloween. That night, there was no need to. Eventually, I threw them away. Interpreter of Maladies. At the tea stall, Mr. and Mrs. Doss bickered about who should take Tina to the toilet. Eventually, Mrs. Doss relented when Mr. Doss pointed out that he had given the girl her bath the night before. In the rearview mirror, Mr. Capazzi watched as Mrs. Doss emerged slowly from his bulky white ambassador, dragging her shaved, largely bare legs across the back seat. She did not hold the little girl's hand as they walked to the restroom. They were on their way to see the Sun Temple at Kanarik. It was a dry, bright Saturday, the mid-July heat tempered by a steady ocean breeze, ideal weather for sightseeing. Ordinarily, Mr. Capazzi would not have stopped so soon along the way, but less than 5 minutes after he'd picked up the family that morning in front of Hotel Sandy Villa, the little girl had complained. The first thing Mr. Capazzi had noticed when he saw Mr. and Mrs. Doss standing with their children under the portico of the hotel was that they were very young, perhaps not even 30. In addition to Tina, they had 2 boys, Ronnie and Bobby, who appeared very close in age and had teeth covered in a network of flashing silver wires. The family looked Indian, but dressed as foreigners did, the children in stiff, brightly colored clothing and caps with translucent visors. Mr. Capazzi was accustomed to foreign tourists. He was assigned to them regularly because he could speak English. Yesterday, he had driven an elderly couple from Scotland, both with spotted faces and fluffy white hair so thin it exposed their sunburnt scalps. In comparison, the tanned, youthful faces of Mr. and Mrs. Doss were all the more striking. When he'd introduced himself, Mr. Capazzi had pressed his palms together in greeting, but Mr. Doss squeezed hands like an American so that Mr. Capazzi felt it in his elbow. Mrs. Doss, for her part, had flexed one side of her mouth, smiling dutifully at Mr. Capazzi without displaying any interest in him. As they waited at the tea stall, Ronnie, who looked like the older of the 2 boys, clambered suddenly out of the back seat, intrigued by a goat tied to a stake in the ground. "Don't touch it," Mr. Doss said. He glanced up from his paperback tour book, which said India in yellow letters and looked as if it had been published abroad. His voice, somehow tentative and a little shrill, sounded as though it had not yet settled into maturity. "I want to give it a piece of gum," the boy called back as he trotted ahead. Mr. Doss stepped out of the car and stretched his legs by squatting briefly to the ground. A clean-shaven man, he looked exactly like a magnified version of Ronnie. He had a sapphire blue visor and was dressed in shorts, sneakers, and a T-shirt. The camera slung around his neck with an impressive telephoto lens and numerous buttons and markings was the only complicated thing he wore. He frowned, watching as Ronnie rushed toward the goat, but appeared to have no intention of intervening. "Bobby, make sure that your brother doesn't do anything stupid." "I don't feel like it," Bobby said, not moving.
He was sitting in the front seat beside Mr. Capazzi, studying a picture of the elephant god taped to the glove compartment.
"No need to worry," Mr. Capazzi said. "They are quite tame."
Mr. Capazzi was 46 years old, with receding hair that had gone completely silver. But his butterscotch complexion and his unlined brow, which he treated in spare moments to dabs of lotus oil balm, made it easy to imagine what he must have looked like at an earlier age. He wore gray trousers and a matching jacket-style shirt, tapered at the waist, with short sleeves and a large pointed collar made of a thin but durable synthetic material. He had specified both the cut and the fabric to his tailor. It was his preferred uniform for giving tours because it did not get crushed during his long hours behind the wheel. Through the windshield, he watched as Ronnie circled around the goat, touched it quickly on its side, then trotted back to the car.
"You left India as a child?"
Mr. Capazzi asked when Mr. Das had settled once again into the passenger seat.
"Oh, Mina and I were both born in America,"
Mr. Das announced with an air of sudden confidence.
"Born and raised.
Our parents live here now in Asansol. They retired. We visit them every couple years." He turned to watch as the little girl ran toward the car, the wide purple bows of her sundress flopping on her narrow brown shoulders. She was holding to her chest a doll with yellow hair that looked as if it had been chopped, as a punitive measure, with a pair of dull scissors.
"This is Tina's first trip to India, isn't it, Tina? I don't have to go to the bathroom anymore,"
Tina announced.
"Where's Mina?"
Mr. Das asked. Mr. Capazzi found it strange that Mr. Das should refer to his wife by her first name when speaking to the little girl. Tina pointed to where Mrs. Das was purchasing something from one of the shirtless men who worked at the tea stall. Mr. Capazzi heard one of the shirtless men sing a phrase from a popular Hindi love song as Mrs. Das walked back to the car, but she did not appear to understand the words of the song, for she did not express irritation or embarrassment or react in any other way to the man's declarations. He observed her. She wore a red and white checkered skirt that stopped above her knees, slip-on shoes with a square wooden heel, and a close-fitting blouse styled like a man's undershirt. The blouse was decorated at chest level with a calico appliqué in the shape of a strawberry. She was a short woman with small hands like paws, her frosty pink fingernails painted to match her lips, and was slightly plump in her figure. Her hair, shorn only a little longer than her husband's, was parted far to one side. She was wearing large, dark brown sunglasses with a pinkish tint to them, and carried a big straw bag, almost as big as her torso, shaped like a bowl, with a water bottle poking out of it. She walked slowly, carrying some puffed rice tossed with peanuts and chili peppers in a large packet made from newspapers. Mr. Capazzi turned to Mr. Das.
"Where in America do you live?"
"New Brunswick, New Jersey."
"Next to New York?"
"Exactly. I teach middle school there."
"What subject?"
"Science. In fact, every year I take my students on a trip to the Museum of Natural History in New York City. In a way, we have a lot in common, you could say, you and I. How long have you been a tour guide, Mr. Capazzi?"
5 years.
Mrs. Das reached the car.
"How long's the trip?" she asked, shutting the door.
"About 2.5 hours, Mr. Capazzi replied.
At this, Mrs. Das gave an impatient sigh as if she had been traveling her whole life without pause. She fanned herself with a folded Bombay film magazine written in English.
"I thought that the Sun Temple is only 18 miles north of Puri," Mr. Das said, tapping on the tour book.
"The roads to Konark are poor.
Actually, it is a distance of 52 miles, Mr. Capazzi explained.
Mr. Das nodded, readjusting the camera strap, where it had begun to chafe the back of his neck. Before starting the ignition, Mr. Capazzi reached back to make sure the crank-like locks on the inside of each of the back doors were secured. As soon as the car began to move, the little girl began to play with the lock on her side, clicking it with some effort, forward and backward. But Mrs. Das said nothing to stop her. She sat a bit slouched at one end of the back seat, not offering her puffed rice to anyone. Ronnie and Tina sat on either side of her, both snapping bright green gum.
"Look," Bobby said as the car began to gather speed.
He pointed with his finger to the tall trees that lined the road.
Look! Monkeys! Ronnie shrieked. Wow!
They were seated in groups along the branches, with shining black faces, silver bodies, horizontal eyebrows, and crested heads. Their long gray tails dangled like a series of ropes among the leaves. A few scratched themselves with black leathery hands or swung their feet, staring as the car passed.
"We call them the Hanuman,"
Mr. Kapazi said. "They're quite common in the area." As soon as he spoke, one of the monkeys leaped into the middle of the road, causing Mr. Kapazi to brake suddenly. Another bounced onto the hood of the car, then sprang away. Mr. Kapazi beeped his horn. The children began to get excited, sucking in their breath and covering their faces partly with their hands. They had never seen monkeys outside of a zoo, Mr. Doss explained. He asked Mr. Kapazi to stop the car so that he could take a picture. While Mr. Doss adjusted his telephoto lens, Mrs. Doss reached into her straw bag and pulled out a bottle of colorless nail polish, which she proceeded to stroke on the tip of her index finger. The little girl stuck out a hand.
"Mine too, Mommy! Do mine too!"
"Leave me alone," Mrs. Doss said, blowing on her nail and turning her body slightly.
"You're making me mess up."
The little girl occupied herself by buttoning and unbuttoning a pinafore on the doll's plastic body. "All set," Mr. Doss said, replacing the lens cap. The car rattled considerably as it raced along the dusty road, causing them all to pop up from their seats every now and then. But Mrs. Doss continued to polish her nails. Mr. Kapazi eased up on the accelerator, hoping to produce a smoother ride. When he reached for the gear shift, the boy in front accommodated him by swinging his hairless knees out of the way. Mr. Kapazi noted that this boy was slightly paler than the other children.
"Daddy, why is the driver sitting on the wrong side in this car, too?" the boy asked.
"They all do that here, dummy," Ronnie said.
"Don't call your brother a dummy," Mr. Doss said. He turned to Mr. Kapazi. "In America, you know, it confuses them."
"Oh, yes, I am well aware,"
Mr. Kapazi said. As delicately as he could, he shifted gears again, accelerating as they approached a hill in the road.
"I see it on Dallas. The steering wheels are on the left-hand side."
"What's Dallas?" Tina asked, banging her now naked doll on the seat beside Mr. Kapazi.
"It went off the air," Mr. Doss explained. "It's a television show."
They were all like siblings, Mr. Kapazi thought, as they passed a row of date trees. Mr. and Mrs. Doss behaved like an older brother and sister, not parents. It seemed that they were in charge of the children only for the day. It was hard to believe they were regularly responsible for anything other than themselves. Mr. Doss tapped on his lens cap and his tour book, dragging his thumbnail occasionally across the pages so that they made a scraping sound. Mrs. Doss continued to polish her nails. She had still not removed her sunglasses. Every now and then, Tina renewed her plea that she wanted her nails done too. And so, at one point, Mrs. Doss flicked a drop of polish on the little girl's finger before depositing the bottle back inside her straw bag.
"Isn't this an air-conditioned car?"
she asked, still blowing on her hand. The window on Tina's side was broken and could not be rolled down.
"Quit complaining," Mr. Doss said. "It isn't so hot."
"I told you to get a car with air conditioning," Mrs. Doss continued. "Why do you do this, Raj? Just to save a few stupid rupees? What are you saving us, 50 cents?
Their accents sounded just like the ones Mr. Kapazi heard on American television programs, though not like the ones on Dallas.
"Doesn't it get tiresome, Mr. Kapazi, showing people the same thing every day?" Mr. Doss asked, rolling down his own window all the way. "Hey, do you mind stopping the car? I just want to get a shot of this guy."
Mr. Kapazi pulled over to the side of the road as Mr. Doss took a picture of a barefoot man, his head wrapped in a dirty turban, seated on top of a cart of grain sacks pulled by a pair of bullocks. Both the man and the bullocks were emaciated. In the back seat, Mrs. Doss gazed out another window at the sky, where nearly transparent clouds passed quickly in front of one another.
"I look forward to it, actually,"
Mr. Capazzi said as they continued on their way.
The Sun Temple is one of my favorite places.
In that way, it is a reward for me.
I give tours on Fridays and Saturdays only. I have another job during the week.
Oh, where? Mr. Doss asked.
I work in a doctor's office.
You're a doctor?
I am not a doctor. I work with one, as an interpreter.
What does a doctor need an interpreter for?
He has a number of Gujarati patients. My father was Gujarati. But many people do not speak Gujarati in this area, including the doctor.
And so the doctor asked me to work in his office, interpreting what the patients say. Interesting. I've never heard of anything like that, Mr. Doss said. Mr. Capazzi shrugged.
It is a job like any other.
But so romantic, Mrs. Doss said dreamily, breaking her extended silence. She lifted her pinkish-brown sunglasses and arranged them on top of her head like a tiara. For the first time, her eyes met Mr. Capazzi's in the rearview mirror. Pale, a bit small, their gaze fixed but drowsy. Mr. Doss craned to look at her.
What's so romantic about it?
I don't know. Something.
She shrugged, knitting her brows together for an instant.
Would you like a piece of gum, Mr. Capazzi?
She asked brightly. She reached into her straw bag and handed him a small square wrapped in green and white striped paper. As soon as Mr. Capazzi put the gum in his mouth, a thick, sweet liquid burst onto his tongue.
Tell us more about your job, Mr. Capazzi, Mrs. Doss said.
What would you like to know, madam?
I don't know.
She shrugged, munching on some puffed rice and licking the mustard oil from the corners of her mouth.
Tell us a typical situation.
She settled back in her seat, her head tilted in a patch of sun, and closed her eyes.
I want to picture what happens.
Very well. The other day, a man came in with a pain in his throat.
Did he smoke cigarettes?
No. It was very curious. He complained that he felt as if there were long pieces of straw stuck in his throat. When I told the doctor, he was able to prescribe the proper medication.
That's so neat.
Yes, Mr. Capazzi agreed after some hesitation.
So these patients are totally dependent on you, Mrs. Doss said.
She spoke slowly as if she were thinking aloud.
In a way, more dependent on you than the doctor.
How do you mean? How could it be?
Well, for example, you could tell the doctor that the pain felt like a burning, not straw. The patient would never know what you had told the doctor, and the doctor wouldn't know that you had told the wrong thing. It's a big responsibility.
Yes, a big responsibility you have there, Mr. Capazzi, Mr. Doss agreed.
Mr. Capazzi had never thought of his job in such complimentary terms. To him, it was a thankless occupation. He found nothing noble in interpreting people's maladies, assiduously translating the symptoms of so many swollen bones, countless cramps of bellies and bowels, spots on people's palms that changed color, shape, or size. The doctor, nearly half his age, had an affinity for bell-bottom trousers, and made humorless jokes about the Congress party. Together they worked in a stale little infirmary where Mr. Capazzi's smartly tailored clothes clung to him in the heat, in spite of the blackened blades of a ceiling fan churning over their heads. The job was a sign of his failings. In his youth, he'd been a devoted scholar of foreign languages, the owner of an impressive collection of dictionaries. He had dreamed of being an interpreter for diplomats and dignitaries, resolving conflicts between people and nations, settling disputes of which he alone could understand both sides. He was a self-educated man. In a series of notebooks, in the evenings before his parents settled his marriage, he had listed the common etymologies of words. And at one point in his life, he was confident that he could converse, if given the opportunity, in English, French, Russian, Portuguese, and Italian, not to mention Hindi, Bengali, Orissi, and Gujarati. Now, only a handful of European phrases remained in his memory.
scattered words for things like saucers and chairs. English was the only non-Indian language he spoke fluently anymore. Mr. Capazzi knew it was not a remarkable talent. Sometimes he feared that his children knew better English than he did, just from watching television. Still, it came in handy for the tours. He had taken the job as an interpreter after his first son, at the age of 7, contracted typhoid. That was how he had first made the acquaintance of the doctor. At the time, Mr. Capazzi had been teaching English in a grammar school, and he bartered his skills as an interpreter to pay the increasingly exorbitant medical bills. In the end, the boy had died one evening in his mother's arms, his limbs burning with fever. But then there was the funeral to pay for, and the other children who were born soon enough, and the newer, bigger house, and the good schools and tutors, and the fine shoes and the television, and the countless other ways he tried to console his wife and to keep her from crying in her sleep. And so, when the doctor offered to pay him twice as much as he earned at the grammar school, he accepted. Mr. Capazzi knew that his wife had little regard for his career as an interpreter. He knew it reminded her of the son she'd lost, and that she resented the other lives he helped in his own small way to save. If ever she referred to his position, she used the phrase, "doctor's assistant," as if the process of interpretation were equal to taking someone's temperature or changing a bedpan. She never asked him about the patients who came to the doctor's office, or said that his job was a big responsibility. For this reason, it flattered Mr. Capazzi that Mrs. Doss was so intrigued by his job. Unlike his wife, she had reminded him of its intellectual challenges. She had also used the word romantic. She did not behave in a romantic way toward her husband, and yet she had used the word to describe him. He wondered if Mr. and Mrs. Doss were a bad match, just as he and his wife were. Perhaps they, too, had little in common apart from 3 children and a decade of their lives. The signs he recognized from his own marriage were there. The bickering, the indifference, the protracted silences. Her sudden interest in him, an interest she did not express in either her husband or her children, was mildly intoxicating. When Mr. Capazzi thought once again about how she had said, "romantic," the feeling of intoxication grew. He began to check his reflection in the rearview mirror as he drove, feeling grateful that he had chosen the gray suit that morning and not the brown one, which tended to sag a little in the knees. From time to time, he glanced through the mirror at Mrs. Doss. In addition to glancing at her face, he glanced at the strawberry between her breasts and the golden brown hollow in her throat. He decided to tell Mrs. Doss about another patient, and another. The young woman who had complained of a sensation of raindrops in her spine. The gentleman whose birthmark had begun to sprout hairs. Mrs. Doss listened attentively, stroking her hair with a small plastic brush that resembled an oval bed of nails, asking more questions for yet another example. The children were quiet, intent on spotting more monkeys in the trees. And Mr. Doss was absorbed by his tour book, so it seemed like a private conversation between Mr. Capazzi and Mrs. Doss. In this manner, the next half hour passed, and when they stopped for lunch at a roadside restaurant that sold fritters and omelet sandwiches, usually something Mr. Capazzi looked forward to on his tours, so that he could sit in peace and enjoy some hot tea, he was disappointed. As the Doss family settled together under a magenta umbrella fringed with white and orange tassels and placed their orders with one of the waiters who marched about in tri-cornered caps, Mr. Capazzi reluctantly headed toward a neighboring table.
"Mr. Capazzi, wait! There's room here!" Mrs. Doss called out.
She gathered Tina onto her lap, insisting that he accompany them. And so, together, they had bottled mango juice and sandwiches and plates of onions and potatoes deep-fried in gram flour batter. After finishing 2 omelet sandwiches, Mr. Doss took more pictures of the group as they ate.
"How much longer?"
he asked Mr. Capazzi, as he paused to load a new roll of film in the camera. about half an hour more. By now the children had gotten up from the table to look at more monkeys perched in a nearby tree, so there was a considerable space between Mrs. Doss and Mr. Capazzi. Mr. Doss placed the camera to his face and squeezed one eye shut, his tongue exposed at one corner of his mouth. "This looks funny, Mina. You need to lean in closer to Mr. Capazzi."
She did. He could smell a scent on her skin, like a mixture of whiskey and rose water.
He worried, suddenly, that she could smell his perspiration, which he knew had collected beneath the synthetic material of his shirt. He polished off his mango juice in one gulp and smoothed his silver hair with his hands. A bit of the juice dripped onto his chin. He wondered if Mrs. Doss had noticed. She had not.
"What's your address, Mr. Capazzi?"
she inquired, fishing for something inside her straw bag.
"You would like my address?"
"So we can send you copies," she said, "of the pictures."
She handed him a scrap of paper, which she had hastily ripped from a page of her film magazine. The blank portion was limited, for the narrow strip was crowded by lines of text and a tiny picture of a hero and heroine embracing under a eucalyptus tree. The paper curled as Mr. Capazzi wrote his address in clear, careful letters. She would write to him, asking about his days interpreting at the doctor's office, and he would respond eloquently, choosing only the most entertaining anecdotes, ones that would make her laugh out loud as she read them in her house in New Jersey. In time, she would reveal the disappointment of her marriage, and he his. In this way, their friendship would grow and flourish. He would possess a picture of the two of them, eating fried onions under a magenta umbrella, which he would keep, he decided, safely tucked between the pages of his Russian grammar. As his mind raced, Mr. Capazzi experienced a mild and pleasant shock. It was similar to a feeling he used to experience long ago, when after months of translating with the aid of a dictionary, he would finally read a passage from a French novel or an Italian sonnet and understand the words one after another, unencumbered by his own efforts. In those moments, Mr. Capazzi used to believe that all was right with the world, that all struggles were rewarded, that all of life's mistakes made sense in the end. The promise that he would hear from Mrs. Doss now filled him with the same belief. When he finished writing his address, Mr. Capazzi handed her the paper, but as soon as he did so, he worried that he had either misspelled his name or accidentally reversed the numbers of his postal code. He dreaded the possibility of a lost letter, the photograph never reaching him, hovering somewhere in Orissa, close but ultimately unattainable. He thought of asking for the slip of paper again, just to make sure he had written the address accurately. But Mrs. Doss had already dropped it into the jumble of her bag. They reached Canarik at 2:30. The temple, made of sandstone, was a massive pyramid-like structure in the shape of a chariot. It was dedicated to the great master of life, the sun, which struck three sides of the edifice as it made its journey each day across the sky. 24 giant wheels were carved on the north and south sides of the plinth. The whole thing was drawn by a team of 7 horses, speeding as if through the heavens. As they approached, Mr. Capazzi explained that the temple had been built between AD 1243 and 1255 with the efforts of 1,200 artisans by the great ruler of the Ganga dynasty, King Narasimhadeva I, to commemorate his victory against the Muslim army. "It says the temple occupies about 170 acres of land," Mr. Doss said, reading from his book.
"It's like a desert," Ronnie said, his eyes wandering across the sand that stretched on all sides beyond the temple.
"The Chandrabhaga River once flowed 1 mile north of here. It is dry now," Mr. Capazzi said, turning off the engine.
They got out and walked toward the temple, posing first for pictures by the pair of lions that flanked the steps. Mr. Capazzi led them next to one of the wheels of a chariot, higher than any human being, 9 feet in diameter. "The wheels are supposed to symbolize the wheel of life," Mr. Doss read. "They depict the cycle of creation, preservation, and achievement of realization." "Cool." He turned the page of his book,
Each wheel is divided into 8 thick and thin spokes, dividing the day into 8 equal parts. The rims are carved with designs of birds and animals, whereas the medallions in the spokes are carved with women in luxurious poses, largely erotic in nature. What he referred to were the countless friezes of entwined naked bodies, making love in various positions, women clinging to the necks of men, their knees wrapped eternally around their lovers' thighs. In addition to these were assorted scenes from daily life of hunting and trading, of deer being killed with bows and arrows, and marching warriors holding swords in their hands. It was no longer possible to enter the temple, for it had filled with rubble years ago, but they admired the exterior, as did all the tourists Mr. Capazzi brought there, slowly strolling along each of its sides. Mr. Das trailed behind, taking pictures. The children ran ahead, pointing to figures of naked people, intrigued in particular by the Nagamithunas, the half-human, half-serpentine couples who were said, Mr. Capazzi told them, to live in the deepest waters of the sea. Mr. Capazzi was pleased that they liked the temple, pleased especially that it appealed to Mrs. Das. She stopped every 3 or 4 paces, staring silently at the carved lovers and the processions of elephants and the topless female musicians beating on 2-sided drums. Though Mr. Capazzi had been to the temple countless times, it occurred to him, as he, too, gazed at the topless women, that he had never seen his own wife fully naked. Even when they had made love, she kept the panels of her blouse hooked together, the string of her petticoat knotted around her waist. He had never admired the backs of his wife's legs the way he now admired those of Mrs. Das, walking as if for his benefit alone. He had, of course, seen plenty of bare limbs before, belonging to the American and European ladies who took his tours. But Mrs. Das was different. Unlike the other women, who had an interest only in the temple and kept their noses buried in a guidebook or their eyes behind the lens of a camera, Mrs. Das had taken an interest in him. Mr. Capazzi was anxious to be alone with her, to continue their private conversation, yet he felt nervous to walk at her side. She was lost behind her sunglasses, ignoring her husband's requests that she pose for another picture, walking past her children as if they were strangers. Worried that he might disturb her, Mr. Capazzi walked ahead, to admire, as he always did, the 3 life-sized bronze avatars of Surya, the sun god, each emerging from its own niche on the temple facade to greet the sun at dawn, noon, and evening. They wore elaborate headdresses, their languid, elongated eyes closed, their bare chests draped with carved chains and amulets. Hibiscus petals, offerings from previous visitors, were strewn at their gray-green feet. The last statue, on the northern wall of the temple, was Mr. Capazzi's favorite. This Surya had a tired expression, weary after a hard day of work, sitting astride a horse with folded legs. Even his horse's eyes were drowsy. Around his body were smaller sculptures of women in pairs, their hips thrust to one side. "Who's that?" Mrs. Das asked. He was startled to see that she was standing beside him.
"He is the Astashala Surya," Mr. Capazzi said. "The setting sun."
"So in a couple of hours the sun will set right here?" She slipped a foot out of one of her square-heeled shoes, rubbed her toes on the back of her other leg.
"That is correct."
She raised her sunglasses for a moment, then put them back on again. "Neat." Mr. Capazzi was not certain exactly what the word suggested, but he had a feeling it was a favorable response. He hoped that Mrs. Das had understood Surya's beauty, his power. Perhaps they would discuss it further in their letters. He would explain things to her, things about India, and she would explain things to him about America. In its own way, this correspondence would fulfill his dream of serving as an interpreter between nations. He looked at her straw bag, delighted that his address lay nestled among its contents. When he pictured her so many thousands of miles away, he plummeted,
so much so that he had an overwhelming urge to wrap his arms around her, to freeze with her, even for an instant, in an embrace witnessed by his favorite Surya. But Mrs. Doss had already started walking.
"When do you return to America?"
he asked, trying to sound placid. "In 10 days.
He calculated.
A week to settle in. A week to develop the pictures. A few days to compose her letter, 2 weeks to get to India by air. According to his schedule, allowing room for delays, he would hear from Mrs. Doss in approximately 6 weeks' time. The family was silent as Mr. Capasi drove them back, a little past 4:30, to Hotel Sandy Villa. The children had bought miniature granite versions of the chariot's wheels at a souvenir stand, and they turned them round in their hands. Mr. Doss continued to read his book. Mrs. Doss untangled Tina's hair with her brush and divided it into two little ponytails. Mr. Capasi was beginning to dread the thought of dropping them off. He was not prepared to begin his 6-week wait to hear from Mrs. Doss. As he stole glances at her in the rearview mirror, wrapping elastic bands around Tina's hair, he wondered how he might make the tour last a little longer. Ordinarily, he sped back to Puri using a shortcut, eager to return home, scrub his feet and hands with sandalwood soap, and enjoy the evening newspaper and a cup of tea that his wife would serve him in silence. The thought of that silence, something to which he'd long been resigned, now oppressed him. It was then that he suggested visiting the hills at Udayagiri and Khandagiri, where a number of monastic dwellings were hewn out of the ground, facing one another across a defile. It was some miles away, but well worth seeing, Mr. Capasi told them.
"Oh, yeah, there's something mentioned about it in this book," Mr. Doss said. "Built by a Jain king or something."
"Shall we go, then?"
Mr. Capasi asked. He paused at a turn in the road.
"It's to the left."
Mr. Doss turned to look at Mrs. Doss. Both of them shrugged.
"Left, left," the children chanted.
Mr. Capasi turned the wheel, almost delirious with relief. He did not know what he would do or say to Mrs. Doss once they arrived at the hills. Perhaps he would tell her what a pleasing smile she had. Perhaps he would compliment her strawberry shirt, which he found irresistibly becoming. Perhaps, when Mr. Doss was busy taking a picture, he would take her hand. He did not have to worry. When they got to the hills, divided by a steep path thick with trees, Mrs. Doss refused to get out of the car. All along the path, dozens of monkeys were seated on stones as well as on the branches of the trees. Their hind legs were stretched out in front and raised to shoulder level, their arms resting on their knees.
"My legs are tired," she said, sinking low in her seat. "I'll stay here."
"Why did you have to wear those stupid shoes?" Mr. Doss said. "You won't be in the pictures."
"Pretend I'm there."
"But we could use one of these pictures for our Christmas card this year. We didn't get one of all 5 of us at the Sun Temple. Mr. Capasi could take it."
"I'm not coming. Anyway, those monkeys give me the creeps."
"But they're harmless," Mr. Doss said. He turned to Mr. Capasi. "Aren't they?"
"They are more hungry than dangerous," Mr. Capasi said. "Do not provoke them with food, and they will not bother you."
Mr. Doss headed up the defile with the children, the boys at his side, the little girl on his shoulders. Mr. Capasi watched as they crossed paths with a Japanese man and woman, the only other tourists there, who paused for a final photograph, then stepped into a nearby car and drove away. As the car disappeared out of view, some of the monkeys called out, emitting soft whooping sounds, and then walked on their flat black hands and feet up the path. At one point, a group of them formed a little ring around Mr. Doss and the children. Tina screamed in delight. Ronnie ran in circles around his father. Bobby bent down and picked up a fat stick on the ground. When he extended it, one of the monkeys approached him and snatched it, then briefly beat the ground.
"I'll join them," Mr. Capasi said, unlocking the door on his side.
There is much to explain about the caves.
No, stay a minute, Mrs. Doss said. She got out of the back seat and slipped in beside Mr. Capazzi. Raj has his dumb book anyway. Together, through the windshield, Mrs. Doss and Mr. Capazzi watched as Bobby and the monkey passed the stick back and forth between them.
A brave little boy, Mr. Capazzi commented.
It's not so surprising, Mrs. Doss said.
No.
He's not his.
I beg your pardon.
Raj's. He's not Raj's son.
Mr. Capazzi felt a prickle on his skin. He reached into his shirt pocket for the small tin of lotus oil balm he carried with him at all times and applied it to three spots on his forehead. He knew that Mrs. Doss was watching him, but he did not turn to face her. Instead, he watched as the figures of Mr. Doss and the children grew smaller, climbing up the steep path, pausing every now and then for a picture, surrounded by a growing number of monkeys.
Are you surprised?
The way she put it made him choose his words with care. It's not the type of thing one assumes, Mr. Capazzi replied slowly. He put the tin of lotus oil balm back in his pocket.
No, of course not. And no one knows, of course. No one at all.
I've kept it a secret for 8 whole years. She looked at Mr. Capazzi, tilting her chin, as if to gain a fresh perspective.
But now I've told you.
Mr. Capazzi nodded. He felt suddenly parched, and his forehead was warm and slightly numb from the balm. He considered asking Mrs. Doss for a sip of water, then decided against it.
We met when we were very young, she said.
She reached into her straw bag in search of something, then pulled out a packet of puffed rice.
Want some?
No, thank you. She put a fistful in her mouth, sank into the seat a little, and looked away from Mr. Capazzi, out the window on her side of the car.
We married when we were still in college.
We were in high school when he proposed. We went to the same college, of course. Back then we couldn't stand the thought of being separated, not for a day, not for a minute. Our parents were best friends who lived in the same town.
My entire life I saw him every weekend, either at our house or theirs.
We were sent upstairs to play together while our parents joked about our marriage. Imagine. They never caught us at anything, though in a way I think it was all more or less a setup. The things we did those Friday and Saturday nights while our parents sat downstairs drinking tea.
I could tell you stories, Mr. Capazzi.
As a result of spending all her time in college with Raj, she continued, she did not make many close friends. There was no one to confide in about him at the end of a difficult day or to share a passing thought or a worry. Her parents now lived on the other side of the world, but she had never been very close to them anyway. After marrying so young, she was overwhelmed by it all, having a child so quickly, and nursing and warming up bottles of milk and testing their temperature against her wrist while Raj was at work, dressed in sweaters and corduroy pants, teaching his students about rocks and dinosaurs. Raj never looked cross or harried, or plump, as she had become after the first baby. Always tired, she declined invitations from her one or two college girlfriends to have lunch or shop in Manhattan. Eventually, the friends stopped calling her, so that she was left at home all day with the baby, surrounded by toys that made her trip when she walked or wince when she sat, always cross and tired. Only occasionally did they go out after Ronnie was born, and even more rarely did they entertain. Raj didn't mind. He looked forward to coming home from teaching and watching television and bouncing Ronnie on his knee. She had been outraged when Raj told her that a Punjabi friend, someone whom she had met once but did not remember, would be staying with them for a week for some job interviews in the New Brunswick area. Bobby was conceived in the afternoon, on a sofa littered with rubber teething toys, after the friend learned that a London pharmaceutical company had hired him, while Ronnie cried to be freed from his playpen. She made no protest when the friend touched the small of her back as she was about to make a pot of coffee, then pulled her against his crisp navy suit. He made love to her swiftly, in silence, with an expertise she had never known. Without the meaningful expressions and smiles Raj always insisted on afterward. The next day, Raj drove the friend to JFK. He was married now, to a Punjabi girl, and they lived in London still, and every year they exchanged Christmas cards with Raj and Meena, each couple tucking photos of their families into the envelopes. He did not know that he was Bobby's father. He never would.
"I beg your pardon, Mrs. Das, but why have you told me this information?"
Mr. Capazzi asked when she had finally finished speaking and had turned to face him once again.
"For God's sake, stop calling me Mrs. Das. I'm 28. You probably have children my age."
"Not quite."
It disturbed Mr. Capazzi to learn that she thought of him as a parent. The feeling he had had toward her that had made him check his reflection in the rearview mirror as they drove evaporated a little.
"I told you because of your talents."
She put the packet of puffed rice back into her bag without folding over the top.
"I don't understand," Mr. Capazzi said.
"Don't you see? For 8 years, I haven't been able to express this to anybody. Not to friends, certainly not to Raj. He doesn't even suspect it. He thinks I'm still in love with him." "Well, don't you have anything to say?"
"About what?"
"About what I've just told you, about my secret, and about how terrible it makes me feel. I feel terrible looking at my children, and at Raj, always terrible. I have terrible urges, Mr. Capazzi, to throw things away. One day I had the urge to throw everything I own out the window, the television, the children, everything. Don't you think it's unhealthy?"
He was silent.
"Mr. Capazzi, don't you have anything to say? I thought that was your job."
"My job is to give tours, Mrs. Das."
"Not that, your other job, as an interpreter."
"But we do not face a language barrier. What need is there for an interpreter?"
"That's not what I mean. I would never have told you otherwise. Don't you realize what it means for me to tell you?"
"What does it mean?"
"It means that I'm tired of feeling so terrible all the time. 8 years, Mr. Capazzi. I've been in pain 8 years. I was hoping you could help me feel better. Say the right thing. Suggest some kind of remedy."
He looked at her, in her red plaid skirt and strawberry t-shirt, a woman not yet 30, who loved neither her husband nor her children, who had already fallen out of love with life. Her confession depressed him. Depressed him all the more when he thought of Mr. Das at the top of the path, Tina clinging to his shoulders, taking pictures of ancient monastic cells cut into the hills to show his students in America, unsuspecting and unaware that one of his sons was not his own. Mr. Capazzi felt insulted that Mrs. Das should ask him to interpret her common, trivial little secret. She did not resemble the patients in the doctor's office. Those who came glassy-eyed and desperate, unable to sleep or breathe or urinate with ease, unable, above all, to give words to their pains. Still, Mr. Capazzi believed it was his duty to assist Mrs. Das. Perhaps he ought to tell her to confess the truth to Mr. Das. He would explain that honesty was the best policy. Honesty, surely, would help her feel better, as she'd put it. Perhaps he would offer to preside over the discussion as a mediator. He decided to begin with the most obvious question, to get to the heart of the matter. And so he asked,
"Is it really pain you feel, Mrs. Das, or is it guilt?"
She turned to him and glared, mustard oil thick on her frosty pink lips. She opened her mouth to say something, but as she glared at Mr. Capazzi, some certain knowledge seemed to pass before her eyes, and she stopped. It crushed him. He knew at that moment that he was not even important enough to be properly insulted. She opened the car door and began walking up the path, wobbling a little on her square wooden heels, reaching into her straw bag to eat handfuls of puff rice. It fell through her fingers, leaving a zigzagging trail, causing a monkey to leap down from a tree and devour the little white grains. In search of more, the monkey began to follow Mrs. Das. Others joined him, so that she was soon being followed by about half a dozen of them, their velvety tails dragging behind. Mr. Capazzi stepped out of the car. He wanted to holler, to alert her in some way, but he worried that if she knew they were behind her, she would grow nervous. Perhaps she would lose her balance. Perhaps they would pull at her bag or her hair. He began to jog up the path, taking a fallen branch in his hand to scare away the monkeys. Mrs. Doss continued walking, oblivious, trailing grains of puffed rice. Near the top of the incline, before a group of cells fronted by a row of squat stone pillars, Mr. Doss was kneeling on the ground, focusing the lens of his camera. The children stood under the arcade, now hiding, now emerging from view.
"Wait for me," Mrs. Doss called out. "I'm coming."
Tina jumped up and down.
"Here comes Mommy!"
"Great," Mr. Doss said without looking up. "Just in time. We'll get Mr. Capazzi to take a picture of the five of us." Mr. Capazzi quickened his pace, waving his branch so that the monkeys scampered away, distracted, in another direction.
"Where's Bobby?"
Mrs. Doss asked when she stopped. Mr. Doss looked up from the camera. "I don't know. Ronnie, where's Bobby?" Ronnie shrugged.
"I thought he was right here."
"Where is he?" Mrs. Doss repeated sharply. "What's wrong with all of you?" They began calling his name, wandering up and down the path a bit. Because they were calling, they did not initially hear the boy's screams. When they found him, a little farther down the path, under a tree, he was surrounded by a group of monkeys, over a dozen of them, pulling at his t-shirt with their long black fingers. The puffed rice Mrs. Doss had spilled was scattered at his feet, raked over by the monkeys' hands. The boy was silent, his body frozen, swift tears running down his startled face. His bare legs were dusty and red with welts, from where one of the monkeys struck him repeatedly with the stick he had given to it earlier.
"Daddy, the monkey's hurting Bobby," Tina said.
Mr. Doss wiped his palms on the front of his shorts. In his nervousness, he accidentally pressed the shutter on his camera. The whirring noise of the advancing film excited the monkeys, and the one with the stick began to beat Bobby more intently.
"What are we supposed to do? What if they start attacking?"
"Mr. Capazzi!"
Mrs. Doss shrieked, noticing him standing to one side.
"Do something, for God's sake! Do something!"
Mr. Capazzi took his branch and shooed them away, hissing at the ones that remained, stomping his feet to scare them. The animals retreated slowly, with a measured gait, obedient but unintimidated. Mr. Capazzi gathered Bobby in his arms and brought him back to where his parents and siblings were standing. As he carried him, he was tempted to whisper a secret into the boy's ear. But Bobby was stunned and shivering with fright, his legs bleeding slightly where the stick had broken the skin. When Mr. Capazzi delivered him to his parents, Mr. Doss brushed some dirt off the boy's t-shirt and put the visor on him the right way. Mrs. Doss reached into her straw bag to find a bandage, which she taped over the cut on his knee. Ronnie offered his brother a fresh piece of gum. "He's fine. He's just a little scared, right, Bobby?" Mr. Doss said, patting the top of his head.
"God, let's get out of here," Mrs. Doss said.
She folded her arms across the strawberry on her chest.
"This place gives me the creeps."
"Yeah, back to the hotel, definitely," Mr. Doss agreed.
"Poor Bobby," Mrs. Doss said. "Come here a second. Let Mommy fix your hair."
Again she reached into her straw bag, this time for her hairbrush, and began to run it around the edges of the translucent visor. When she whipped out the hairbrush, the slip of paper with Mr. Capazzi's address on it fluttered away in the wind. No one but Mr. Capazzi noticed. He watched, as it rose, carried higher and higher by the breeze, into the trees where the monkeys now sat, solemnly observing the scene below. Mr. Capazzi observed it too. Knowing that this was the picture of the Doss family, he would preserve forever in his mind.
A Real Door One. Buri Ma, sweeper of the stairwell, had not slept in two nights. So the morning before the third night, she shook the mites out of her bedding. She shook the quilts once underneath the letterboxes where she lived, then once again at the mouth of the alley, causing the crows who were feeding on vegetable peels to scatter in several directions. As she started up the four flights to the roof, Buri Ma
kept one hand placed over the knee that swelled at the start of every rainy season. That meant that her bucket, quilts, and the bundle of reeds which served as her broom all had to be braced under one arm. Lately, Buri Ma had been thinking that the stairs were getting steeper. Climbing them felt more like climbing a ladder than a staircase. She was 64 years old, with hair in a knot no larger than a walnut, and she looked almost as narrow from the front as she did from the side. In fact, the only thing that appeared three-dimensional about Buri Ma was her voice, brittle with sorrows, as tart as curds, and shrill enough to grate meat from a coconut. It was with this voice that she enumerated twice a day as she swept the stairwell, the details of her plight and losses suffered since her deportation to Calcutta after partition. At that time, she maintained, the turmoil had separated her from a husband, four daughters, a two-story brick house, a rosewood almari, and a number of coffer boxes whose skeleton keys she still wore, along with her life savings, tied to the free end of her sari. Aside from her hardships, the other thing Buri Ma liked to chronicle was easier times. And so, by the time she reached the second-floor landing, she had already drawn to the whole building's attention the menu of her third daughter's wedding night. "We married her to a school principal. The rice was cooked in rose water. The mayor was invited. Everybody washed their fingers in pewter bowls." Here she paused, evened out her breath, and readjusted the supplies under her arm. She took the opportunity also to chase a cockroach out of the banister poles, then continued, "Mustard prawns were steamed in banana leaves. Not a delicacy was spared. Not that this was an extravagance for us. At our house, we ate goat twice a week. We had a pond on our property full of fish." By now, Buri Ma could see some light from the roof spilling into the stairwell. And though it was only 8 o'clock, the sun was already strong enough to warm the last of the cement steps under her feet. It was a very old building, the kind with bathwater that still had to be stored in drums, windows without glass, and privy scaffolds made of bricks. "A man came to pick our dates and guavas. Another clipped hibiscus. Yes, there I tasted life. Here I eat my dinner from a rice pot." At this point in the recital, Buri Ma's ears started to burn. A pain chewed through her swollen knee. "Have I mentioned that I crossed the border with just 2 bracelets on my wrist? Yet there was a day when my feet touched nothing but marble. Believe me, don't believe me. Such comforts, you cannot even dream them." Whether there was any truth to Buri Ma's litanies, no one could be sure. For one thing, every day, the perimeters of her former estate seemed to double, as did the contents of her almari and coffer boxes. No one doubted she was a refugee. The accent in her Bengali made that clear. Still, the residents of this particular flat building could not reconcile Buri Ma's claims to prior wealth alongside the more likely account of how she had crossed the East Bengal border with the thousands of others on the back of a truck between sacks of hemp. And yet there were days when Buri Ma insisted that she had come to Calcutta on a bullock cart. "Which was it, by truck or by cart?" the children sometimes asked her on their way to play cops and robbers in the alley. To which Buri Ma would reply, shaking the free end of her sari so that the skeleton keys rattled, "Why demand specifics? Why scrape lime from a beetle leaf? Believe me, don't believe me, my life is composed of such griefs you cannot even dream them." So she garbled facts. She contradicted herself. She embellished almost everything. But her rants were so persuasive, her fretting so vivid, that it was not so easy to dismiss her. "What kind of landowner ended up sweeping stairs?" That was what Mr. Dullal of the third floor always wondered as he passed Buri Ma on his way to and from the office, where he filed receipts for a wholesale distributor of rubber tubes, pipes, and valve fittings in the plumbing district of College Street. "Bechara. She probably constructs tales as a way of mourning the loss of her family," was the collective surmise of most of the wives. And "Buri Ma's mouth is full of ashes, but she is the victim of changing times," was the refrain of old Mr. Chatterjee. He had neither strayed from his balcony nor opened a newspaper since independence, but in spite of this fact, or maybe because of it, his opinions were always highly esteemed.
the theory eventually circulated that Burima had once worked as hired help for a prosperous zamindar back east, and was therefore capable of exaggerating her past at such elaborate lengths and heights. Her throaty impostures hurt no one. All agreed that she was a superb entertainer. In exchange for her lodging below the letterboxes, Burima kept their crooked stairwell spotlessly clean. Most of all, the residents liked that Burima, who slept each night behind the collapsible gate, stood guard between them and the outside world. No one in this particular flat building owned much worth stealing. The second-floor widow, Mrs. Misra, was the only one with a telephone. Still, the residents were thankful that Burima patrolled activities in the alley, screened the itinerant peddlers who came to sell combs and shawls from door to door, was able to summon a rickshaw at a moment's calling, and could, with a few slaps of her broom, rout any suspicious character who strayed into the area in order to spit, urinate, or cause some other trouble. In short, over the years, Burima's services came to resemble those of a real Durwan. Though under normal circumstances this was no job for a woman, she honored the responsibility and maintained a vigil no less punctilious than if she were the gatekeeper of a house on Lower Circular Road or Jodhpur Park or any other fancy neighborhood. On the rooftop, Burima hung her quilts over the clothesline. The wire, strung diagonally from one corner of the parapet to the other, stretched across her view of television antennas, billboards, and the distant arches of Howrah Bridge. Burima consulted the horizon on all four sides. Then she ran the tap at the base of the cistern. She washed her face, rinsed her feet, and rubbed two fingers over her teeth. After this, she started to beat the quilts on each side with her broom. Every now and then she stopped and squinted at the cement, hoping to identify the culprit of her sleepless nights. She was so absorbed in this process that it was some moments before she noticed Mrs. Dalal of the third floor, who had come to set a tray of salted lemon peels out to dry in the sun.
"Whatever is inside this quilt is keeping me awake at night," Burima said. "Tell me, where do you see them?"
Mrs. Dalal had a soft spot for Burima. Occasionally she gave the old woman some ginger paste with which to flavor her stews. "I don't see anything," Mrs. Dalal said after a while. She had diaphanous eyelids and very slender toes with rings on them.
"Then they must have wings," Burima concluded.
She put down her broom and observed one cloud passing behind another.
"They fly away before I can squash them. But just see my back. I must be purple from their bites."
Mrs. Dalal lifted the drape of Borima's sari, a cheap white weave with a border the color of a dirty pond. She examined the skin above and below her blouse, cut in a style no longer sold in shops. Then she said, "Burima, you are imagining things."
"I tell you, these mites are eating me alive."
"It could be a case of prickly heat," Mrs. Dalal suggested. At this, Burima shook the free end of her sari and made her skeleton keys rattle.
She said, "I know prickly heat. This is not prickly heat. I haven't slept in 3, perhaps 4 days. Who can count? I used to keep a clean bed. Our linens were muslin. Believe me, don't believe me, our mosquito nets were as soft as silk. Such comforts, you cannot even dream them."
"I cannot dream them," Mrs. Dalal echoed. She lowered her diaphanous eyelids and sighed. "I cannot dream them, Burima. I live in 2 broken rooms, married to a man who sells toilet parts." Mrs. Dalal turned away and looked at one of the quilts. She ran a finger over part of the stitching, then she asked, "Burima, how long have you slept on this bedding?" Burima put a finger to her lips before replying that she could not remember. "Then why no mention of it until today? Do you think it's beyond us to provide you with clean quilts? An oilcloth, for that matter." She looked insulted.
"There is no need," Burima said. "They're clean now. I beat them with my broom."